Yeah, and I've been doing, and this is kind of a bit of a transition to your questions and things, but I've been doing more of my research on kind of the psychology of decision making.
Ah, okay. Well, me too, 'cause
Yeah, I saw that. So it seemed like there's kind of a your timing was really good too, because there are three areas that I've been looking into, and I've been really trying to focus on how people sense emerging risks. Right, so like what actually is your kind of your risk sensing and your risk tolerance level, right? The second is how do you game out when you're thinking about these risks that you have maybe thought about before or just haven't really had a protocol for? How do you game out? Like, what would you actually think about in terms of options?
Oh, yeah.
Right, and then the third part is this idea of sense making. So, what would be the triggers that would cause you to actually respond? What is kind of the level of risk, threat, or vulnerability, one or all of those that would cause you to take action?
Okay, it's interesting you mentioned the word vulnerability there. There's a little bit of a trend in Australia now to move away from outright risk management to trying to scan the horizons for vulnerabilities. It
Yeah,
sounds
I
like a
think,
change in
yeah.
terminology, but it's actually trying to morph the thinking of corporate heads to scan the horizon for vulnerabilities rather than, okay, what are the existing risks and how do we manage them? So I don't know whether that's going to
Yeah.
get traction or not.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, so the organization I work for is the University of California, and I work in the office of the president, and they have a risk services office, and that office was traditionally more or less insurance, right? So, for instance, if there's a big workplace violence case, or if there's some kind of an accident, or if there's a medical malpractice, you buy insurance against it.
Oh, okay.
And when I got hired, I wasn't from the insurance business side of things, and I had my background was mostly in planning for crises and emergencies. So I said, so what are we doing to actually prevent some of these things? Or if we can't prevent them, because we can't prevent them all, like cyber issues, they're going to happen. What are we doing to actually sense that they're coming at us? So it's an issue of kind of vulnerability and resilience. And it turns out, and this is why I want to talk to you about this in terms of the decision making. I think the gap is that most of the leaders have never been trained in any of these skills.
Yeah, I would agree.
So I mean, unless you're from the military or the fire service or the maybe law enforcement or maybe emergency management, those are not career paths that get people into a C-suite.
Yeah.
You've probably never even handled intelligence reports.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Right,
So
so you don't even understand what intelligence is, and you might have a preconceived notion of something like spying.
yes.
You know what I mean? You'll have so your thoughts about the term or the process might just be kind of very thin. And so I said, okay, well then let's change the term to risk sensing rather than call it what it really is, which is intelligence collection. Right. So how do you, so the first question is, in terms of decision making, what process or protocols do you have in place to sense emerging risks?
Yeah, your
Right.
intelligence gathering network.
You got it. Right. And most people will say, well, what are you suggesting? And what essentially you're suggesting is an intelligence gathering network. Real time, forward looking, early warning with triggers, and then an actionable insight, which is just the intelligence cycle.
And of course, that's going to be
So
different
that,
depending upon the industry.
yeah. So, for instance, yours might be changes in the supply levels or the requirements for blood, or it could be a bloodborne pathogen that changes things where you can't accept blood because something's changed, like Zika, right? So that would be a intelligence issue. You would want to collect information, verify, and then say what would be some early warning signs that we would build in and say, for instance, if I see this happening, then that tells me that there's been a change, that the risk environment has changed. It's become more risky or less risky or the same.
Mm-hmm.
And then what would I do if some of these trends are experienced? Like, for instance, for us, in higher education, the trends are things going online.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? So what if, you know, 20 years' time, we're still considered not being one of the leaders in this field? Are people going to start saying, you know what, it's just not worth going and spending all this money to sit in the classroom. I can go to this other very prestigious school and get the majority of my classes online.
Yeah, yeah, of course. Right? And when so, I want them.
Yeah, and if this school doesn't want to do that and this other school does, then I'll go to them, you know. So that's a risk, but it's a vulnerability too, because the vulnerability is that you could be an early adopter and you could actually say, you know what, we're going to be working to make ourselves better positioned so that if this does, the landscape does change and we see these disruptive impacts, we're going to be better positioned to survive that kind of event.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's what I've been focusing on now, is the risk sensing, which is really just the intelligence, sense making, which is helping people to game out their strategies, and then building in this resilience, having this kind of robust intelligence collection, gaming process, and then vulnerability reduction.
So, correct me if I've got this wrong, that situation or environment that you're creating then is all geared towards making the decisions for the decision maker really easy.
Yeah, well, and I'm also trying to deal with what we know about human behavior, and I'll suggest a really good book that distills this down and makes it very clear. It's called Risk Savvy.
Okay.
And it's called How to Make Good Decisions, and it's a guy who's he works for the Max Planck Institute of Behavioral Psychology, but essentially what he says is we have human behavior we know about that's generally adverse to change.
Right.
And we know from history and from past events that that's usually a liability. Because we're not learning, and we're repeating the same basic decision flaws,
mm-hmm.
and it ends up producing pretty predictable results. These catastrophic human errors with lack of resiliency, lack of intelligence, and we just continue to do that. Why is that? And we know it's because human behavior runs counter to change.
Yes, humans will be humans.
You know, yeah, and normally the only real event that's going to cause a major change is a catastrophic loss.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the organizations that are most resilient are those that have experienced the catastrophic loss if they live to survive through it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
that's the driver of, as you say, a major change to make sure that doesn't happen again.
Right. And apart from that, largely the organizations will essentially see the risk, acknowledge it, insure against it, come up with some cosmetic protocols, you know, that are essentially like we'll bring somebody on to be the risk manager or, you know, like in your position. And that's not to say that's a bad thing, but ultimately that doesn't produce the organizational change.
Mm-hmm. So talking about the micro gaming you were talking about, which of course is test running or desktop exercises around whatever the environment you want to test, are there any sort of decision models or decision making training that you've been able to offer to anybody?
Yeah, I've been doing this now for 24 months. So we just concluded a large a micro game for all of the leaders of the, so the University of California has 10 campuses across the state of California.
Mm-hmm.
So each campus is autonomous in as much as it has its own chancellor, which essentially is like a college president.
Right.
And then, but we've unfortunately, we've had a series of near misses and close calls and some fatal, where we've had events like shootings,
yeah,
stabbings, cyber breaches, sexual harassment claims, and some of these were really catastrophic issues. I mean, we had loss of life in UC Santa Barbara. And in any event, So last month I facilitated a full day session for all of the leaders of all the 10 campuses, going through a number of scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to get them out of the, so there was a bit of a build up to the scenario, which is, this is not about tactics. We're not going to solve the problem of like violence or cyber attacks.
No.
That's not the purpose of doing this. The purpose is to become, first of all, to raise awareness about process to mitigate the negative impact. Now, you're not gonna, this isn't prevention.
Mm.
You might through some of this prevent, but you might not ever really know because you can't prove a negative, right? I might do some things that will make it more difficult for someone to say hack.
Yes.
But I can't for sure say, you know, that I prevented it, because how many of those attacks do I know were potentially successful or not. You know,
yeah,
you don't really know. There's a lot of the signals and the noise, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But what you can do is you can create more resiliency in terms of decision-making process by practicing.
Yeah.
You can build in some forward-looking risk scanning in the process, so you have some early warning. And then you can talk about and build in some framework for protocol, for response protocols.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. And the some of the decision-making protocols are what are called fast and frugal heuristics,
uh-huh,
which are in this book that I mentioned to you, Risk Savvy.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's from my own work, which is from the Marine Corps, which essentially was, people need to practice over and over again their approach to decision making for these very novel cases, because it's sometimes you might not ever experience one of these events, but if you've never walked through the decision making process, you're going to really you're setting yourself up for failure.
Right. So it's a little bit like a flight simulator. If I sat in one not being a pilot, I would be overwhelmed, and yet a pilot can sit in one and test out the most outrageous flight simulations. This is the same thing. This is the chance to put the decision maker at the helm, as it were.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy. Because before you go into the simulator, there's a lot of work you do, you know, up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you would never just say, well, let's see how this goes. You know, you wouldn't just throw somebody in there and say, hey, I hope it works out. But essentially, that's what we do with some of our leaders for, you know, risk, crisis, and emergency training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we there's a certain, so this is another one of these human behaviors. We kind of assume, well, this person has somehow been successful enough to get it to this point. So, you know, they should be able to work through one of these major issues. This life experience plus their professional abilities will help them to get through. And that's true, but you would never do that for something, say, like a budgeting cycle. You wouldn't just say, well, you know, they've never done a budget before, but they seem to be good enough, so let's just see how this works out.
Mm-hmm. So,
you know, you would expect that there should be somebody that understands profit and loss and rate of return and acceptable rate. I mean, all of that before you would ever just say, okay, you're in charge of the budgeting process.
Yeah, true. So
yeah.
Do you find it's beneficial to take baby steps at first and then work up situations that really ramp the pressure up on the decision maker or the crisis leader?
Yeah, you know, there's a bunch of different ways, different kind of schools of thought of this. I think that the people should not be surprised, first of all, by the scenario. Mm-hmm. So there are some that say, let's let them go in there and it'll be kind of a pressure test. But, you know, again, going back to the flight simulator scenario that you just gave, you wouldn't just put somebody in the scenario and say, well, you know, it's a very high kind of a pressure thing. Let's see how they do.
Mm-hmm.
You'd want them to walk through a number of different lesser stress scenarios so that they're working up. So basically, when they're finally put to these tests, they're replicating, you know, what works.
Mm.
So, yeah, I do think that it's better in terms of process to let people, first of all, know what the scenario is, to give them opportunities to slowly walk through this, you know, so that the pressure is not on in the initial learning environment.
Mm-hmm. Now,
you know, and then as, yeah.
No, sorry, Philip. I was going to say I'm a big fan of heuristic decision making, and especially the fast and frugal heuristics.
Oh, great! Yep.
In my book, I've devoted some pages to describing how it's beneficial to use it, particularly when you're under pressure. But do you want to go ahead and give us your take on how effective they are, or what you see as the steps to effective frugal decision making?
Yeah. So the challenge is I don't have a lot of empirical evidence. In other words, I haven't done a study.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a bit concerned to give advice because, you know, somebody could easily say, well, what proof do you have?
Fair enough.
But I do have proof to the counterposition, which is Daniel Kahneman, who is the Nobel laureate. He's a psychologist, but he won the Nobel Prize in economics for behavioral economics. He wrote, you're probably familiar, Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yes.
Right. So one of the things, so this is what I think is the strength of making the case for teaching decision and fast and frugal techniques is his research shows that business leaders tend to ignore or downplay the possibility of random or uncontrolled occurrences.
Mm-hmm.
And that alone ought to be justification for saying, well, then there ought to be a better way of doing things. Now, I'm not sure if fast and frugal is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
It's one way. But absent that, I ask people, well, what system are you using? Right? So, for instance, I've had some, because the people I deal with are PhDs, faculty members, they're very accomplished in their fields,
mm-hmm.
and they're used to research-based decision-making, so if there's not a published research, you know, they're very skeptical, which is good.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, so their first reaction to anything is, well, show me the research that supports that this is actually, you know, valid. And my what I do up front is to say, I'll show you research that supports the failure of good decision making first. Let me just show you that, right? So that's Kahneman's work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now I will show you where fast and frugal has worked. I can't give you a research study. I don't have it. So that's just, you know, being totally transparent. I don't have a study where I could say, okay, here's a group of people that had no decision making training previous to a crisis, and here's how it went, and then this is because there's too many variables.
Yes.
But the Marine Corps, another organization not at all like higher education or most organizations, teaches their junior leaders, which I was, and non-commissioned officers and commissioned officers, they teach them what's called combat decision making, which is fast and frugal heuristics.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because their environment is so potentially dangerous, including loss of lives, they put a lot of faith in the idea that you need to teach people how to make good decisions before they have to be in that environment.
Mm.
So, you know, you could look into that, but even that doesn't carry a lot of weight, frankly, with business people, because a lot of times they'll hear, well, that's fine for the military, you know.
Yes, yeah, true.
What's that got to do with me?
Just going back to what you were saying, I too have done a lot of work with, shall we say, academics who their whole sense of purpose is around disproving stuff to be able to prove what is most correct or most likely.
Yeah.
So I found
and
that.
And then that, you know, I mean,
sorry, Phil, go on.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's absolutely valid in a constant environment where you can work through the process, and the process or the situation is not dynamic or changing. But I think what you're talking about with frugal heuristics is, of course, making decisions in a rapidly changing environment. Is that about the mark?
Yeah, exactly. So it is. It's not, as you just mentioned, it's not a sterile environment. It's rapidly changing. It's hard to do, kind of bench testing of this, so to speak. But I think the strong argument is that, rather than kind of, rather than support fast and frugal as the only way, my first question is, what system do you use? Right?
That might be answer that with, I don't know, I'm just making decisions. Talking people through that?
So my experience has been, most people will not say, I don't know, because they're embarrassed to admit that. That's the truth. Right? They don't use a protocol. They rely on gut instinct, which is and it's not to say that you shouldn't. In some cases, you've got gut instinct is really not just a base judgment. It's based on a lot of things. Experience, your wisdom, from life, your sense of what's happening in the organization, which might be more attuned than anybody else, but it might be also mirror imaging, you could be relying on your own very siloed view, and then someone comes from the outside and says, yeah, but when you look at your organization from the outside, you're very vulnerable in this one. You didn't see it. There's blind spots.
Yeah.
So most people will say, I think, essentially, I use an advisory group. We use, some of the regulatory issues, but in terms of actual process, when you strip it down, they haven't really thought about this because this isn't their field.
Fair enough.
So I think that at least for the work that I've been doing, the soft approach, so to speak, is to say, okay, so I open up with questions, and there's usually, and I was trying to send you part of my slide deck, which if you send me, I don't know if you sent me an email.
I did, yes.
Okay, so let me see if I can't send this to you while we're on the phone. I've got a invitation to, let's see, maybe this is it. Excuse me while I try to do this while we're, okay, this looks like it'll come back to you. So I'll attach a slide deck and it'll show you a little bit of what I've been doing. But so it starts out with these questions: what system do you use now to evaluate emerging risks? Okay. Second question is: what process do you use to make decisions about those emerging risks? And then the third question is: how do you test that process?
Okay, and this is structuring the executive or the crisis team to sit down and just basically scope out their system?
Yep, absolutely. So it's a little bit of a litmus test. I think it's fairly non-threatening because, you ask the questions before you ever get in the room. So I provide, the questions to people. I say, we're going to consider these issues. And if you have thoughts or you've got protocol or things that you've done that are successful, let's bring that in because this isn't a test. The whole goal of this is to increase your resilience. That's the whole purpose of doing this. It isn't an evaluation. It isn't an audit. This isn't a exercise. This is really kind of active learning.
Right.
So I'm not here to tell you that you've got a gap or not, although I might have some beliefs about those, which, if you're open to it, I'll share it with you. But essentially, the goal here is for you to walk out of here and say, I've thought now, I've had this chance to think about where we are with our risk and our crisis and our emergency footing, so to speak, and I think there's some things we could do differently, right? So it's provides a little bit of a jumping off point.
Do you find and then go on.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, do you find that exercising the crises or running through this process lends itself to asking the decision maker to keep it simple, or you're sort of supporting them to be creative in the problem solving and the decision making? Which way do you think it seems to swing people?
It's both. And frankly, I think it depends on the individual, you know, in terms of what takeaways they get from it. Because at the end, we do what's called a plus delta, where I'm essentially serving not as a subject matter expert, although people, you know, just by the process and they know your background, they expect you to kind of come into the room and have a position on some of this.
Mm.
But I tell them my first role is just to give you an opportunity to think through some of this. This is an opportunity for strategic decision planning and et cetera,
mm-hmm.
right? We're not going to solve these problems in the room, but it gives you a chance to step away from the here and now and think about approach and strategy. These are really, you know, facilitated strategy sessions.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why the scenario itself is a backdrop. I tell people generally, you know, as much as we want to think about the scenario, and I normally solicit from people their ideas on what would be what they consider to be plausible scenarios that could have a negative impact on the organization, rather than me coming in and making them up.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have a sense as to what there are some of the things that they're just worried about. You know, that we kind of call these, you know, what should be keeping you up at night.
Fair enough.
You know, not what's keeping you up at night, because that's the here and now. You're dealing with that. But let's step away and say, you know, what do you think you ought to be paying attention to? Maybe there's something that you know is kind of a looming liability, but you just, for whatever reason, don't have the time or the resources or the band, whatever it is, but it ought to be something that we're talking about. So let's talk about that.
Hmm.
And so you get a mix of approaches. Some people say, you know what, I've walked away from this with a list of things that I know I need to go back and do, and I'm going to get those done because I feel right now more vulnerable than I did when I walked in here. You allow me to step away from the here and now and putting out fires and think about what that smoldering platform is on the horizon that I just really have not, you know, because I'm so busy. I'm busy taking care of business, and if we're in the profit and loss, I don't have time to do this. And the whole point of this is to say, you can do this on your own in an hour.
Yeah.
That's why we want to, we can do, you could do this on a quarterly basis in an hour and have one of you, or you could be the facilitator. You don't need a consultant, right? You know, the whole idea is to build this capability as an internal process improvement, not something you've got to call someone like me or you know, someone else. I want to help you so that you can do this your own.
So this approach would even lend itself to anyone on even a personal level to sit down with their husband or wife or family and look at, you know, these are the things we face and these are the things we're doing, but what else is happening? What might be keeping us up at night?
And you know, as much as I'm a practitioner of this, I'm also probably, you know, like, I sit there and my wife says, you know, you teach this, but we don't do enough of this. And I'm like, yeah, you're right about that. You know, because, I mean, I'm also busy sitting there doing this research and stuff. And she's like, you know, but we've got some things that we could be, you know, you're right. You know, so, I mean, sometimes the best perspective is from the person that's outside the loop, you know?
Yes, I've got a great saying for that one in that the motor mechanic goes home and reads a book and the librarian goes home and tinkers with their car. It's what you do is not what you want to do when you've got your downtime.
You got it. Yeah, I'm like, there's other things I want to be doing other than doing some scenario planning, you know?
Fair enough.
But you can take this on a micro level or a macro level and definitely have an application to it. I think that the biggest benefit to doing this for an organization is that they become more resilient.
Mm.
You know, that if for no other reason they've done some creative decision making, and that's, you know, that doesn't end when the micro game is over. You get people and they're like, you know, I hadn't thought about this, but this gets me to think about my own department.
So do you find that there's an absolute need to then, shall we say, list or detail everything in a written plan, or there's a large swath of this that can be just committed to dealing with it on the fly, having practiced these things in the first place?
Yeah, I think, again, I hate to give the same answer to every question you ask, but I think it's a little of both. So I tell people when we're doing these, you know, first of all, if you've got a list, bring it. You know, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to have some kind of artificial boundary to say, no, we're not going to consider any of the things that are on your list. I mean, if you've got a risk list, you bring it. And if you don't, you know, maybe this is a chance for you to do some creative thinking about what should be on the list, because most of this is question driven rather than giving people, you know, here's the answer.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's no school book solution. I have some thought. I think Fast and Frugal is a good model. But there could be another model that someone else uses that works for them. Fine, bring it in. You know, but the point is, absent a model, we know fairly convincingly that not having a decision process is a liability.
Right.
Right, and if for no other reason that, let's say you had a catastrophic loss and there was, you know, some external and internal review, the first thing they're going to ask you is, well, what did you do to prevent this? What was the what process did you use to recognize that an event like this could occur? You know, who was doing it? When did you know? And what did you know? And what did you do to fix this? And, you know, if you're going to go to ground, if your response to that is, you know, we're not going to talk about that, people are going to assume that that means you didn't know and you weren't doing anything.
Yeah, and that
and you didn't have a
reflects
you know.
Badly on you.
And now you have a reputational risk as well as an operational risk, because you're your own worst enemy. You didn't do the things that even a layperson, you know, would say, well, geez, if I was running an engineering company, I would have done a little bit of thought about what happens if the bridge fails. You know, and you're telling me that you can't talk about that. Why? That should be the first thing you should be able to say. Yeah, we looked at these risks, we evaluated them. Here's the assessment. I mean, why would you not be, you know, kind of making your own case?
A corporate sense or a business sense, do you find that there's any different specific areas of crises that you can separate out, or it's just one big crisis beginning to end? So you mentioned previously reputational risk and or business risk or financial risk. Do you see them as being separate, or do you see them as everything's on the table to be discussed at once, or we can...
They're all on the table, but in terms of clarity, I do think you have to kind of decide what you're going to take on, just because of the fact that this could go down a number of different kind of paths, and you could not really end up with any action, right? So, I mean, that's unfortunately, that's the critique I have of some of the exercises. They cover so much ground that when it's all done, it's a mile wide and an inch thick, you know? Nobody walks away and understands, okay, so we did that. It was interesting, but what was the objective? What do we do now?
Right.
And it seems... You know, and it's hard to, you know, stand back and critique other approaches because I'm biased towards mine and against theirs. But, you know, a lot of these things end up to be kind of a check in the box. Okay, we did that. You know, so I would say, for instance, when we've done the risk scenarios, I generally tell people, come up with plausible events that you believe represent those emerging risks. Right, and generally, if it's like for a bank, most of the banks they just go right to the change in the international monetary market. You know, everybody, because they know what that looks like. We've already experienced it. Right, for them, that's the looming liability. So let's start with the one that everybody has buy-in to. You know, and then talk through that, because because that's got to get a lot more organizational traction and buy-in than, say an operational, like a cyber hacking type scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can get a little bit creative and say, let's talk about a plausible story where someone actually manipulates the market, and it's at your bank. Someone is like, say, I don't know if you've heard about some of these traders that are able to shadow trade without the bank actually knowing it. They call them whales.
Yes.
You know, and they find out 6 months or 18 months later, wow, we just had someone on our own books who moved billions of dollars, and it's gone.
Yeah.
You know, so then the question is, like, how could this go on for so long, and you guys not know this is so much money? How could you, like, do you move so much money that you don't miss a million or a billion dollars?
Yeah, it is a bit of a worry, isn't it?
You know, and you know, the kind of the average person thinks, you know, if you can't track $1 billion, how are you going to track my money?
Absolutely.
You know, so it's a confidence. So I asked him, come up with a plausible scenario that's either occurred in the past, or better yet, you think is one of these things that's on the horizon. And it is better, I think, to kind of keep these focused on one specific risk initially. You know, the more convoluted and interesting a scenario gets, people are really into those. But in the end, again, what's the objective? Is it to just tell a very compelling, interesting story, or is it to try to make changes, you know, that you can measure?
Do you find, either in these simulations or when you retrospectively go back and look at what decisions were actually made in various crises, that the results are different when you are seeking to avoid failure rather than seeking success? Do you think that's an influencer?
That's very interesting. I haven't had a chance to really... So that just talks about risk tolerance in a way, right? So if an organization is very risk adverse, let's say, then maybe, you know, but I wouldn't know how to... you would have to actually go back and look at what their risk tolerance was.
Mm.
That might be hard to tell, but that's a good question. I just haven't really spent a lot of time on that. I do know, for instance, we have two organizations that are almost diametrically opposed. One is very, they want to manage their risk well, so they're doing a lot of this work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they might be more resilient, but it's hard to, you know, it's really hard to say because I don't know if they're preventing things. I know they're more aware, though.
Right.
Okay. And now I juxtapose that to another part of our organization that is, they seem to be creating their own risks.
How's that?
Their lack of a protocol and process is constantly called out, both in the press and in their internal audits, as a risk itself. And so I'm thinking, is one organization more resilient than the other? It seems that way, you know?
Okay, fair enough.
But it's hard to kind of quantify because what one's experiencing what seems like self-inflicted wounds because they don't have, they're just not using, it's hard to tell what kind of process or protocol they're actually using. You know, and they're constantly being evaluated and asked, what protocol or why aren't you preventing these things? And they don't seem to have any meaningful answer. Whereas another part of the organization is really invested in this, but they're also not experiencing the same kinds of problems. And maybe there's a cause and effect. But you know, the one thing is causation is not. We can't put a value on someone's efforts and say that prevented something.
Right. So you know? Would I be correct in perhaps assuming you're the author of a book, Failure is an Option, a Primer and Guide for Managing Crises. What was your motivator behind putting this book together?
Well, my wife.
Good answer.
You know, probably similar to yours.
Yes.
So, you know, and I tell people the story, and it might not be fully accurate, but at least it's the way I remember it. I used to pull out these boxes of all these different papers and things that I had done and worked on, and I would try to gather up all this and produce, you know, some kind of a paper or a presentation, and she said, you know, you ought to just get all this stuff in one place and then write a book.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, these are literally cardboard boxes that I have in my attic, you know. And I thought, oh, I just can't. I mean, look at all this stuff. But, you know, there was a lot of what she was saying was that, yeah, look at all this stuff. Every single time you do this, it's like you're going through this pain. Because it was really a pain, you know. I mean, kind of a mental pain of, you know, I got to go find this stuff, and where is it, and I'm losing it, and my memory, you know. So that combined with a colleague of mine who was a dean at a school where I taught, who said, you know, you get a lot of legitimacy from putting all this in one place, even if it's just a short, you know, primer on this, because if you're teaching it, and you want people to know something, but you don't agree with what others have said about it, why don't you just put your own material out there?
Mm-hmm. So is there any sort of story behind the title you chose?
Yeah, it's juxtaposed to, there was a mantra at NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration in the United States, that was you can actually Google this. They had the head of their mission control wrote a book that said, that was called Failure is Not an Option.
Mm-hmm.
And then they lost two of their shuttles. I don't know if you remember this.
Yes,
Discovery. And you know, they had a review, and I read the review, and it said, you know, because they had this belief, and people couldn't really even talk about failure because they had this idea that you couldn't bring it up.
Mm.
It just wasn't something you could talk about. You couldn't talk about failure there, so people hid their failures.
Mm.
And one of their engineers, 24 months before the failure of Challenger, was telling them, you know, if we don't fix this problem with this expansion joint and this this grommet that goes in between here, we're going to lose one of our shuttles. And they told him, well, that's fine. That's your opinion. But it wasn't an opinion. It was an engineering. He had done bench studies. So anyway, I thought, you know what? I've been in a lot of organizations where you cannot talk about problems, not in an open and productive way to fix them.
Okay, so that's sort of harping back to what I mentioned before of avoiding failure rather than seeking success.
Yeah, avoiding it, or also putting a negative connotation on anyone who talks about, you know, problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you're a naysayer, or you always see, you see nothing, but you don't see opportunity. I see opportunity fine, but I'm not going to see opportunity and not see also the potential that we're going to make a mistake and we should fix that.
Yeah.
You know?
So that basically you sat down and came up with sort of the antithesis of that book title.
Yeah, it was to say, you know, that there is failure is in fact something that's healthy to think about. Because if you and I sit down and we could sit down and over an hour or so say, so where are we vulnerable?
Mm-hmm.
Which again goes back to the military. I spent 8 years in the Marine Corps, and a lot of that time was war gaming. You mm-hmm. know, saying, okay, so we're going to go out and do this. And we're going to do it in a country that we know is adversarial to us politically and militarily. What can we do to reduce the potential that what we do doesn't get end in some kind of casualty?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it was really drilled into my head that because I was a leader, the last thing you want to do is be the person that didn't plan enough.
True.
You know, because you're either lazy. Or you say, well, I didn't have time, and those are all excuses, you know. There's always enough time to at least think through some of your options. You might not solve the problem, but I have experienced very few situations where there wasn't enough time in the beginning to at least think through some options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, I think it's also a feeble excuse, frankly, for a lot of organizational failure where people say, well, you're asking me to commit. So, well, how much time do you commit to it now?
True.
Right? So if your commitment is zero, okay, yeah, I'm asking you to commit more time than zero.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I also wonder, and that's why these things start out with questions, so what is your process to reduce your vulnerability?
Mm.
How much time are you invested in? And this is the unfortunate part. In the United States, quite a few large organizations invest very little time in problem recognition and problem vulnerability reduction.
Now, I know you might be splitting hairs here, but you, like me, are very fond of the word invest rather than spend.
I don't know whether you're consciously
saying that or not, but I've likened investment in emergency management is an investment, not an expense. Got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about it until you. I mean, in the as precise as you just said. But so here's the challenge: how do you measure return on investment for doing resilience planning and vulnerability reduction?
Mm.
See, this for people that are really driven by profit and loss, which I'm not. You know, I think that you ought to be profitable, but you can still be profitable and take care of people.
Mm.
Right, because ultimately this comes down to trying to limit a negative impact to some person or people, right?
Yeah.
So if your whole kind of worldview is that everything has to be measured by dollars, and if it isn't, then you question, you know, the value.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, this is going to be kind of an esoteric thing for you.
So, and of course, this throws on to something that I think myself and many other people call the piano accordion effect. If we become resilient and very good at scanning the horizon for vulnerabilities and stopping them occurring, it appears that we are dealing with these issues. So now we don't need to either run exercises or have a risk management division. And so we'll cut back on that, shall we say, expense. And now we do start to, as time goes by, have more risk events happening or accidents and what have you. So we now hire more security or more risk managers. They fix the problem and the problem starts to go away. So we then downsize the risk management team.
Yeah.
And it just becomes an ever-expanding and contracting problem for an organization, hence the term the piano accordion effect.
Yeah, that's a neat way to put it. You know, again, I think this goes back to kind of where we started with the idea of, you know, behavioral decision-making and the work of Kleinman and others in this space about the way in which people approach risk generally, you know, and look at when you say I'm going to work on this issue, what is your understanding of success? Like, what does success look like to you? You know, and so some people have, so they could say, well, you solved enough of the problem.
Yeah.
You know. So a colleague of mine calls this like, what's your acceptable level of risk, and how much do you invest in order to say I've invested enough?
Hmm.
You know, so you get some, you feel like, you know what, we're not going to look at this as an investment. We're going to look at this as an expense. So we're going to expend X amount of money on this problem like any other. And then once we've spent that's our spend, then we're done.
Yeah.
And then we get into this self-perpetuating cycle of, okay, you hired somebody, they did some work, you reduced your risk exposure, you back off, you have a catastrophic loss, you go back, you hire somebody, you know, and you go into this. And, you know, frankly, I think, I don't know that there's a solution to that. I think it's a problem that's just one of the, kind of the landscape of this work.
Mm-hmm. Human nature.
And frankly, I've heard people, you know, they get very frustrated and they say, I've got to convince my boss, you know, and I'm thinking, well, do you really think there's some magic solution to getting people? I just don't, maybe I've become cynical. I don't know. I think it's more realistic to say, I don't expect to convert people.
True.
You know, I just think that would be really nice if it could happen. But my expectation is that people are going to see the value in resilience.
Mm-hmm.
To being more resilient, and that might be good enough.
Yeah, it's an interesting term. Good enough is something I know in the emergency field. We've certainly found that good enough quite often is good enough.
Yeah. I mean, so, you have to, I think, and each organization has its own culture and each leader has his own perspective. And, so at least in my work, I've thought, if I'm going to try to get people to understand that there is value in some protocol to sense risk, gain out its potential, and come up with ways of reducing, the negative impact of this, then I have to accept that people will have totally different versions of what they accept as acceptable levels of risk. Their risk tolerance could be completely different than mine, and that's just what we know about human behavior.
So.
I might not agree with it, but that doesn't necessarily matter.
True. So.
Now,
Philip, you've been very generous with your time this morning, so I might just wrap it up, but I'd like to maybe take a left turn and ask you some very different questions, just in closing.
Sure, absolutely.
If you had to offer yourself, your younger self, some advice about making up your mind or a point of wisdom about choices and decisions, what would that be? So, you were a 20-year-old.
Frankly, I was very blessed. First of all, I believe I'm a Christian. I know this is a bit outside the scope, so I'll just give you this. I was very blessed to have mentors.
Uh-huh.
And so if my advice to my younger self would be, there's wisdom and experience, and you want to really slow down and listen to those that have gone before you.
Wow, that's a good one. I like that.
And that would be, that I can't really think of anything that's more important, because that's what I tell my kids now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'll give you a really quick little story. It has very little to do with this, but I heard it from a comedian, and it just made me laugh. He said to his daughter one time, he said, "How old are you?" And she was 15. And he said, "Okay, so you're 15 now. When you're 20, do you think you'll be smarter or dumber than you are now?" And she said, "Well, of course, in 5 years, I should be smarter." I said, "All right, when you're 30, do you think you'll be smarter or dumber than you were when you're 20?
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Dad, I'm going to be smarter." He said, "Okay, I'm 50 years old. Why is it that you assume that everything I say doesn't have any wisdom to it?" And it made sense, because it's a practical way of getting someone to think, you expect that you should be getting smarter.
Mm.
And here's this person. I mean, there are old people that don't have wisdom that, we see, unfortunately. But the majority of the people that have been there and done that have done well because they've made decent choices.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if they're in our field. There's a certain thing. I've dealt with people that are PhDs in physics and engineering, but they've never dealt in the field I'm in. They have no wisdom whatsoever in the field I'm in.
Actually, I was speaking with my wife just the other day, and I was reading a little bit of research that said studies on chess players, grandmasters, were conducted thinking that they may be the epitome of decision-making, and yet the research showed that the great chess players aren't actually any wiser or different to the rest of us. They're just good at chess.
Yeah, so I mean, like for instance, my younger self, I was very blessed that I was able to be around very wise mentors in the areas that I was working in, which was in aviation. These people had been through Vietnam, and that not all of them made it through whole, so to speak, but some did, and they had a lot to say about how to not get killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that was a big blessing. And I'm at that stage in my career, it meant a lot, because I didn't want to die, going to work every day.
That's certainly a motivator to listen up.
Yeah. So that's kind of a very, my advice would be, heed the wisdom of people that are working in a field that you're working in who seem to have navigated it well,
Mm-hmm. All right, then. Well, thanks very much for your time. It's been fascinating stuff, and actually I would like to talk to you some more,
perhaps
later. But just before we go, if people want to find out more about you, How can they go about it? Websites, Google Plus, Facebook, anything like
that? Yeah, I don't have a lot of social media presence because I'm doing work in violence risk, and some of the people that are subjected to the process that I'm working on are crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I try to keep my social media presence to a very minimum. But if people were interested, I teach a class online, so anyone can enroll at UCLA Extension.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could go to UC, they could go into Google and just Google my name and UCLA Extension. It's called, the long name of the course is Human, Legal, and Ethical Implications of Emergency Management and Homeland Security.
Goodness, okay. Try and fit that on a brochure.
Yeah, I know it's a very long title, but the easiest way is just Google my name and UCLA Extension, and anyone anywhere in the world can enroll in that.
Okay. You're Philip with a double L.
Yep.
Van Saun. Have I got that right?
Van Saun. V-A-N. Yeah, Van Saun. V-A-N-S-A-U-N. Two words.
And, of course, you've got a book that's available by Amazon.
Yep, it's on Amazon.
Okay, and again, just Google your name and that'll come up.
Yep, they'll come up.
Cool. Fantastic. All right. Well, Philip, thank you very much for your time. And
absolutely, Russ. Great talking to you. Yeah, and if you ever get out here again to California, please let me know.
Oh, it's on the cards. Don't worry.